Hi, I'm Monse, and this is Musings of the Artist, a podcast where I have meaningful conversations with all kinds of artists.
Victoria Chang is a poet, writer, and editor. Her new book of poetry is The Trees Witness Everything. Her other books include Obit and Dear Memory, letters on writing, silence, and grief. In this episode, we chat about collaboration in art, her wonderful and varied use of form in her writing, and her current role as poetry editor at the New York Times Magazine. We also talk about growing up between cultures and the realization that the very things that make us different are often, as Victoria notes, our strengths. So here is my conversation with Victoria Chang.
One of the things I love about so much of your work, I see these questions you're asking that you there's no way for you to really get answers to. And I'm very intrigued by that too, you know, of sort of the circling around questions that we may never know the full answer to, you know, and that to me is what is so exciting about writing is sort of the exploration, not so much the end result.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, I think so much of why people start writing is not related to, oh, I want to publish a book. You know, it's so much of like, I have these questions and I'm not sure even what those questions are or how to articulate those questions, but somehow some of us are built in a way that we just naturally pick up a pencil or a pen and start writing in order to process things. You know, other people do many other things, but the first thing I do is I just grab a pen or a pencil and it's like, wow, I need to do that in order to process things. I also like to converse, and that's another way in which I navigate the world too.
There's this real feeling of collaboration in all that you do. And, you know, for Dear Memory, you pepper the prose with other literary voices by way of passages and quotes. And in The Trees Witness Everything, which is a brilliant title, by the way, you bring in W.S. Merwin as a collaborator through the title of your poems and in other ways as well throughout your work. And I love this about what you do. And I just wanted to hear you talk about that. And that's like an intentional thing that you do when you sit down to write, or just sort of spills in naturally?
Yeah. I mean, I think that I'm naturally a collaborative person and that I feel like I do my best work, my best thinking, my best making, my best living when I interact with other people. And so one of my friends called me and actually himself a correspondence poet. And I love that word and I've been using it a lot. I think of myself as a correspondent artist, you know, like I feel like it's just anytime I'm in a room with other people, I feel like all the ideas are better. Unfortunately, writing is hard to do with other people. It's odd that I've actually selected writing or writing selected me as something that one of the many things that I do. But I definitely think one way to, you know, sort of mimic that room when you're chatting with lots of people and there are all kinds of cool things that are coming up and pressing against and people disagreeing or agreeing and riffing off of people's other ideas is corresponding with various things. And in each book that you describe and probably others, I'm corresponding with all sorts of things, you know, whether it's writing and quotes and ideas and thoughts from other people that I agree with, or I slant a little bit, or I press entirely against. Or there are things like I just finished an ekphrastic book of poems on the paintings of Agnes Martin. And so that's just all corresponding with someone else's visual art and also her writing and her thinking. And there are a couple other artists that I talk about and correspond with in that, you know, manuscript. And right now I'm working on something related to trees. And so I'm talking to and corresponding to trees. And so I feel like for me, it's always needing some body or bodies to press against, with, toward, away from, in order to do my best thinking, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, totally, totally. I mean, I think that's also, and I'm sure you have this experience, like all of us avid readers and writers, you know, when I'm reading a book, So, I mean, I take a long time to read a book because I will read a line and it'll suddenly open up this whole world of memory and me and something that happened. And then I have to go write that thing, you know? So,
sure.
I mean, I think that's one of the most exciting things about this path, you know, of an artist, of a writer, as is being able to be in conversation with all those that come before you or that are your contemporaries. So yeah, I just really, that is a very palpable thing in your work. And I just really love that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I actually just recorded a talk for the MFA program I work at. And the talk was on how to put together a poetry manuscript. And I said something like a writer or a poet is a descendant first, a poet second, you know, and that sort of implies that we are a part of something larger than ourselves first. And I think poets oftentimes and writers can be very narcissistic and self-focused. And I think that when that happens and that narcissism kind of, and we all are to some extent, but
totally.
when it leaks through too much is when I think that we've forgotten that we are connected in so many ways to people before us and our contemporaries and our future people that aren't even born yet. And I think that when we decide, you know, like maybe not decide, when we work in a vacuum and become so self-absorbed, that shows up in the art too. And I'm just personally not as interested in reading that kind of art or looking at that kind of art. I'm sure other people might say, actually, I prefer that kind of art, but I prefer art that feels like it's reaching and extending around and toward and away from other people and other artwork as well.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. And that is a really challenging thing, though, I think, of writing memoir. You know, I'm a creative nonfiction focused in school. And so that's always the forefront of my mind is like, how is this in conversation with something larger than myself, you know?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Because otherwise, it's just like, how does it move from navel gazing or how does it move from a journal entry or a diary to something that is bigger than the self and the oneness of your experience and what you're writing about. And that's the hardest thing. I mean, I clearly struggle with that with Dear Memory as well.
Well, right. Because I mean, of course, the tricky part of that is to resonate, you have to be specific with your own story. You can't just be like, I had a traumatic childhood at the end. You know, you have to like be very specific about your situation. But I think, you know, as you're speaking, it's making me think that it's sort of partly about intention, perhaps, because, you know, if you go to the page with just thinking about yourself and that's it, and you're not thinking about the greater community and world, you know, then that's probably going to come across.
Yeah. I mean, it's like meeting someone that literally just talks about themselves the whole time. And we've all met people like that. And then, you know, or looking, I mean, I hate to bring social media into this, but it's like watching someone's social media be like literally like a selfie a day. And it's
totally.
Like, who do you think is interested in seeing that, you know? But people do it all the time. And it's just this lack of self-awareness kind of thing. And you think that somebody would actually make a like some kind of rating system that automatically tells you before you post something when you're preparing it that nope, don't do this one, don't do that one, too narcissistic, too this. I mean, we all need help in that department. I think to be on social media is to openly say I'm going to be judged, and it's a very difficult thing to do well, as we witness every day, because people don't do it well all the time, including myself. And we make mistakes all day long to public ridicule behind our backs. So, but yeah, to go back to art, I do think people can feel that. But I think the hardest thing is to figure out how to do that, like how to make something that's not just so self-focused that people aren't going to be interested in it. And there's no one way. And for every single thing that you're working on, it could demand some different way of doing that. And that's where craft comes into play. I know some people don't like the word craft, but I use, you know, the word craft to be very malleable. It could mean a lot of different things, but the how, you know, the how we do it is never the same necessarily. And so I think the thing that a lot of, you know, maybe writers that are at the earlier stage in their writing development is that they just sort of copy what other people are doing. And I think that's a great way to learn. But I think that can also make the writing not really listen to the speaker's sort of own sense of identity and individualism, and also what the particular thing you're working on is asking of you. It's like you spend so much time listening to other people's voices that you lose your own sense of self. Yeah.
Yeah, and you see that happen a lot.
Yeah, totally. Right. I mean, originality, right? I mean, it's like why does everything sound the same? Or why do so many books sound the same? Why do so many memoirs sound the same? Why do so many poems and books of poems sound the same? It's because we're not as different as we think we are. I think that's the first thing. And I also think we make the mistake of listening too much to what our culture is doing at large, and we lose our sense of self
yes.
in the process.
Absolutely. And I was just thinking as you're speaking about this is because one thing that really, as I've been in this MFA program, that I notice my peers and even myself as well, I'm concerned with is, and not necessarily voice of like, you know, taking someone else's voice, but what about like subject matter, for example, because, you know, especially with social media, as I'm, I'll use myself as an example, working on a project and I'm hyper-focused on this. And then you go on social media and then you see somebody talking, like just published a book that's basically the exact same thing that you're working on. Mm-hmm. And it's really, it's a challenge I find to shut that and say like, just because they did it doesn't mean I can't do it because it's going to sound different, you know, because we are different people. But I notice a lot of people in my program too struggle with that when even as far as like a reading, if someone does a reading and they read a new piece, they're like, oh, I had a very similar idea. Now I shouldn't do it because they did it better. You know, we get so in our heads about this stuff, you know?
Well, I think that's also this idea of comparison that is really unhealthy, but it's totally natural. I mean, I just had a similar conversation with someone else who has a book coming out next year, and somebody else has a book that they think might be similar to that book. And, you know, I get it. It's totally a natural impulse. And I think it's good to just lean into those impulses and to listen to those impulses and to acknowledge them, you know, and to name them, but then to also like have the conviction to do your own thing. And even if it is kind of similar, it's kind of, you know, not the end of the world. Yeah. I mean, some people have straight up, I think, and I don't have full evidence of it, copied, you know, my entire ideas, and I don't care, you know. I mean, initially I was really offended and I was like, wow, that's you just basically stole my thing, but I have no evidence, but the timing of it. But then it's like, at the end of the day, I was like, you know, you can block them on social media and then you can just say, I don't care, because either way, what they do is not going to be the same. Like, you know, I think people are just going to do that. And I think that sometimes I even hesitate to publish any poems that I've been writing telling people, but you know, it's like, I'm just like, well, I'll just tell everybody I'm done with this manuscript on ekphrastic poems on Agnes Martin. Hey, if someone wants to write a book of poems on Agnes Martin, go for it.
You know, right. Like, I'm like, not going to be your voice.
Well, also the world could use more ekphrastic
poems. Totally. That's a beautiful way to look at it too.
And there's more room for many people to talk about the same subject matter. And it's just, it's broad and there are riches everywhere. But in the scarcity model mentality, which is very much so driven by our culture of capitalism, this is what we get. And it's awful. And I feel awful even having thought those things myself. But again, we name it and we acknowledge it and we know that's human and also part of this culture. And then you put it aside and you just, you know, go write your stuff.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I thank you for saying all that, because I think a lot of people need to hear that. Yeah. And actually, you know, as you're saying that, I'm sort of thinking too, like how I actually currently, I get excited when I see somebody that's doing something similar to the thing I'm doing, because I don't know, it excites me. And I'm like, oh, this is like, I get to read, you know, the way that they're doing it. And
sure,
you know, so there's
you get
also
to learn.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it is tricky because we're so competitive. I mean, this is such a
social media has made us that way. You know?
No, I think I would argue it's really just brought what was already implicit out explicitly. We are already made that way. And the writing community is so competitive to begin with. And social media has just sort of brought it out and exacerbated it. And, you know, I think it's sort of makes us and forces us to be more self-aware, and then also to learn as we go in the process about ourselves. I mean, social media is a way of, I think, reflecting also a mirror on ourselves. Like when we see how other people are acting on social media, instead of like always criticizing everyone, I tend to just say, wait, do I do that too?
Right, right.
You know, I think that's a healthier way to be, because I think poets and writers and I mean, we can all be so catty and so ungenerous. And I don't really think that's a healthy way to live.
Yeah, so totally agree. And yeah, it's a great way to look at it. I wanted to talk to you also about your brilliant use of form. It's another thing I love about your work. And so Obit uses, for those who haven't read it, uses the form of obituaries in a newspaper. And the trees witness everything is made up of small poems and prose poems. And Dear Memory uses the epistolary form and is also in conversation with images. And I'm really currently obsessed, it actually is more the word, with the ways that form can mirror the subject matter. You know, and I was just thinking, I was writing sort of recently about my fragmented cultural identity, and I wanted to write it in an essay form, and I just naturally started writing it as a segmented essay. And, you know, later I tried to sort of morph it into a more traditional structure, but it was like asking to be fragmented. And I was thinking, of course it was, because that's sort of mirroring the subject of it. And I just wondered, you know, for you, how much do form and subject matter play together? And, you know, which comes first for you in the process? Do you sort of think this is going to be an epistolary book, or do you just start writing and then it reveals itself?
Yeah, I mean, I would say more often than not, I'm trying to figure things out as I go, really kind of letting the writing decide how it wants to be. And my thinking is also that any piece of writing has more than one way of emerging. So that's the beauty of it. There's really no, and I wrote this in the talk that I just gave too, that there really is no one way to organize a poetry manuscript or a book of essays or a book of fiction. It's all just one of many, many different ways. And I think once you think about it that way, you may free yourself of the pressure of, oh, I must write this perfect book and there's only one way. But in terms of form, I think in general, most often than not, I think I'm trying to figure things out as I go, and I'm not really sure what I'm doing. In the case of the trees witness everything, I did actually dictate the form ahead of time because I was trying really hard to do something, which is to avoid a particular specific subject matter after writing a book like Obit, which felt really subject matter heavy to me. And so that was, I guess, top down versus bottoms up kind of thing, mm-hmm. you know, and deductive versus inductive. And because my friend had told me that he liked the short tankas, the short poems in Obit. And hey, you know, he's like, you should write a bunch of short poems, you know, and I think you're really good at them. And you, and I was like, okay. And so I, you know, wrote a lot, much longer book. He said 40 pages, and I'm looking here, this is 120 plus pages. And there are two on each page. So that's double the number of the small poems that he said. But for me, I succeeded because the process felt very fun and very freeing, in that I was just writing using W.S. Merwin's titles, which is another constraint, and syllabics and syllables, you know, I was counting on my fingers the whole time. And it was just joyful because I had no idea what I was going to write as I was writing, because I had all these things, other things that I had to grapple with, you know, instead of saying, I'm going to think about grief. And, you know, it's like it became not that while I was writing the book of poems, Obit, I was, you know, I mean, those poems wander all over the place. So my mind is naturally very associative, but clearly there's subject matter there. And so for the trees witness everything, I purposely for my own sanity, I thought it'd be fun to try something very different.
Do you find it, because I think it's so interesting, because you mentioned sort of putting constraints, you know, it's almost like you think that would make it harder, but I think it does the opposite. It makes it a lot easier. It's like an entryway into things.
Sure. And it gives you something to press against, you know, their guardrails that are actually quite freeing. And I always liken it to bowling. You know, it's like if you put guardrails up, it's like your worries are all gone, you know?
Well, that's such a good analogy. I love that. Okay. So I wanted to talk to you about something you write so beautifully in both interviews I've read and also your work, especially Dear Memory, on this in-betweenness and otherness that, you know, one can feel when living between cultures. You wrote something in an interview you said something in an interview that I really related to, and I wanted to ask you about it. You said, "I was constantly navigating cultures. Now I think of these things as a luxury. Before, I thought I was a problem. That's how I viewed it. Only recently would I say I have begun to make art from coming out of those spaces versus seeing myself or the way I am as a problem." Mm-hmm. And that resonated so deeply, as I mentioned. It's, you know, I grew up between cultures as well. And I was just sort of thinking about how, you know, inside my house, it was one thing and then outside was another, and how I just, when I was younger, and I think reading your work, it sounds similar. Like I was younger, I wanted to morph into that culture that I felt like an outsider from. And at this point in my life, I am actually very grateful for that otherness. And I wanted to change my name, you know, when I was younger. Now I wouldn't trade it for anything. And it just makes me think about how sometimes the very things we used to run from are now the things that we run towards. Mm-hmm. And I just would love to hear you talk about how your experiences of culture changed from when you were young versus how you feel about it now.
Yeah, I think all the things that you said resonate with me as well. I feel like when you're younger, so much about growing up is about, and coming of age is about fitting in. And we are, you know, we're pack creatures, you know, we're groups, you know, we're part of larger communities. And I feel like so much of that is just leaning into wanting to be like other people. And when you're a minority in any particular way, you know, whether it's you're a woman or an Asian American woman, or, you know, all of us can be intersectionally cut into so many different ways, mm-hmm. and cross intersecting, I suppose. Cut is maybe not the right word, but, you know, we're all multiplicities, and, you know, we contain multitudes, right? Was what Whitman said and or wrote. And I feel like that's how we all are. I mean, I was thinking when you were talking that so many people grow up in a family where the mother and the father, or the father and father, or mother and mother, or whoever, you know, like they're really different from each other. And yeah. I think that's also a way that can make people feel bifurcated. And I was thinking about how my mother is from China originally and left a war when she was younger, and then left another country, Taiwan, and to come to America. And my dad is Taiwanese. He was born in Taiwan. And so he didn't have that history of war quite as strongly as my mother did, but he did grow up under Japanese occupation. And so everybody's a little bit different. And so the way they navigated their own sort of experiences and trauma was different from each other. And maybe one, like my dad, didn't even think of it as trauma, you know, whereas my mom maybe did so. I mean, I'm projecting things onto them at this point because they're not around anymore. But I definitely feel like we're all grappling with those things at the same time. And then to add on to the fact that, you know, it's like if your parents are from a different country, or they're from different countries than each other, or you live somewhere where no one looks like you, which is pretty much where I grew up. And then I actually grew up in a Jewish community, which
mm-hmm. added another,
yeah, which was really cool, actually, mm-hmm. but also had another layer of complication onto it, because what, you know, the environment that I grew up in, the Jewish community in particular that I grew up in, it was very strong, and it was very community-based and close and tight-knit with each other. So that was another layer of confusion for me, because I was very isolated and saw that my you know, colleagues and classmates be very close to each other. And so there were those things that I grew up with too that were hard. And then, you know, people make fun of you when you're little because you're mm-hmm. different. And yeah, even as an adult, it's like I was and am different than I think a lot of poets, for example, and a lot of writers, especially of my generation, because people mostly, for the most part, did the similar things within reason. You know, like most people went to get an MFA earlier than I did, and then they went to go do whatever. You know, it's like I was always doing 8,000 things, and none of them were, or a very small part of them, those things was poetry. And so I think that I felt different than all of my poetry friends and writing friends. And frankly, those groups can be very unaccepting. It's like it's like biology. Like they're like a group of cells and they sense that you're different, the cell, like you're a germ or something. And then they'll just like, you know, you'll touch them by accident, you'll run into them and they'll just like kick you out. And that's very much so what it felt like early on as a poet. And now I recognize all the things that made me different were all along my strengths. And I'm so mad at myself, but, you know, obviously when you're younger, you can forgive your younger self. But I'm so mad at myself for letting other people dictate my own self-esteem and my own identity. And now I have just recognized that, oh, I think I'm just this way and that's who I am. So you can take it or leave it. And I don't care anymore.
Oh my gosh. I resonated so much with everything you said. And I was just thinking about how some of these, the ways that these really negative things that happen, actually maybe those negative things might be the driving factors of sort of what ends up being the most positive things, you know?
Definitely. I mean, I think that's so true, but I think we can't see that until much later. And the struggle is real, you know, the struggle is part of the process as well. And I mean, I think you get to a certain age where you really just can't care anymore. But until you get to that age, it really is still hard to be alive and to navigate all kinds of different people who can be very difficult to be around or difficult people in the world. You know, it's like, it's just, there's so many things that just flummox me and have shocked me over my lifetime in terms of how people have reacted or said things or lied about things. I'm just constantly amazed, you know, when I can't be amazed anymore, something else happens. And I think that's a part of life. That's how you learn.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You don't know until you know, right?
So true. And the whole time, I mean, one would think one should be, I would imagine, assessing and reassessing the self and thinking about, oh, what could I have done better? Or how should I be? Or what kind of person do I want to be? How should I be thinking about this? Or what are the, you know, I mean, asking yourself a lot of questions, because I think that's a good way to learn, you know, not in a self-blaming way, but just kind of asking how you may want to respond or not respond bodily and emotionally to a lot of the, I would say, stimuli in the world coming at us today, because there's definitely not a dearth of stimuli, I would say.
Yeah, totally. I just wanted to quickly touch on the incredible artwork in Dear Memory, because I'm currently working with an archive, and I will say it is not easy to do this well. So I'm just really just blown away by the care that you have put into this, and just it's so profound and beautiful. And it also it made me think. I don't know if you, do you know the artist Priya Kambli? She's a photographer. She works primarily with her archives, and her parents died young, and she inherited.
Oh yeah, I've seen her work before. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's amazing. And she was interesting because
She's a real artist.
Who are you? I heard you saying I'm not a visual artist. I was like, what?
Oh no, I'm not Priya Kambli. Like she's a real artist. Yeah. Oh. No.
Well, I don't know. She is, but so are you, I would argue. What's interesting, you know, I took a class with her, and so I was just,
oh wow.
Yeah, I love her.
Amazing.
Yeah, she was talking about I found this so fascinating because in your book, you know, there's certain places where you do, will have text over a face, or you replace the face with something else, which is a thing. I'm trying to do this with a project about my grandmother, and it's very tricky to figure out the right way to do this and not feel like you're erasing them and all these things. And anyways, Priya was explaining that she has these photos of her mother, and her mother was actually carved out her own face from the photos. And Priya has no idea why. So she can only guess, but, you know, she doesn't know. And I just find that so fascinating, you know, and she's like, I don't think it was vanity. I think it was something else. Like maybe, you know, she didn't want her father taking the photos or whatever. But I just find that so fascinating, you know, thinking about how we worry so much, or think, not worry, but concern ourselves with how to do the sort of erasure of these photos, and here her mother did it herself, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the poet Diana Kuai Nguyen, I don't know if you know her work at all, and the book is Ghost Of, and her brother had committed suicide, and you can Google it, you'll see that the brother actually cut himself before he committed suicide, cut himself out of photos as well, and then she creates these beautiful images from that and writing around it. It's really beautiful work. Yeah.
Oh, so thank you for that recommendation.
Yeah. But there are many different ways to deal with those kinds of things. And, you know, doctoring photos and maybe changing them is nothing new. Like, people have been doing it forever. And so I feel like I did nothing original, but I think it's kind of really thinking about what each, like, you know, your particular project is. And for me, you know, it was just kind of, well, I had to figure that out as I went, and it was really hard. And I called for help from friends. And I also thought a lot about, like, what I was writing about and how, and that really shaped, like, what I did with my collages and things like that, which I think is just naturally different than what other people would do with their collages, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. And I think I've been thinking a lot about text and image lately, because those are my sort of two obsessions, is writing and photography. And I think it's very difficult to do this well, because what you want to do is you don't want to have a mirror exactly, you know, you don't want the image to just be a replication of the text. You want it to enhance each other. So, and I think that's what you do so beautifully. And I just flipped the book open, and I just remember how much I love this one. You have a poem next to a photo of your mother with, I think, two of her friends, the one where the two friends are wearing flower dresses. And you say, even then, your stare was slightly lower, looking right beneath where happiness begins. And that just, like, pierced me when I read it in conjunction with the photo, because, you know, I wouldn't have noticed that about her eyes and where they were, and how you bring that out with your words. I just
think it's great. Oh, thank you. Yeah. It's so, you know, I really thought about what my sort of, like, what my skill sets are. And I was thinking, well, I grew up drawing and took a ton of art classes, but it's not something that I've been doing and practicing very regularly over the last bunch of decades. And so I was thinking, what have I been doing? Well, I've been writing poems. And, you know, one of my friends was like, you should write poems off of these photos. And I was like, yeah, I should, because that's kind of what I know how to do, if that makes sense, you know? And so I feel like I tried really hard to really think about what I think I'm better at, if that makes sense. And so I think that the language in some of those little collages that where I wrote the poems may help make up for a little bit of the weakness of the visual aspects. And so thinking about those things while you're making it subconsciously can be helpful too. Like, what do you like to do, and what maybe you're not as good at, and how to, you know, use all of your gifts, if that makes sense.
Totally. Of course. I wanted to ask you about being the editor of the New York Times Magazine's poetry column, which must be so cool. And I read that it was important to you to bring in lesser known poets and presses, which I was, like, cheering when I read that, because that's so important to me too, to be reading, you know, lesser known authors and from lesser known
which is everyone. I mean, really, when we really think about it, it's just about everyone. You know, it's like there, like, I mean, there are so few writers that are actually known.
That is true. Well, that's it, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, because I try to ask most people this question, and especially want to hear your answer, since it is, I know, important to you. I was wondering if you could maybe give us a few names of lesser known artists, you know, in particular that you just want everyone to know about that maybe you don't think people know about.
Oh, again, I really feel like it's everyone. I mean, it's like everyone that I've put in the poetry column, almost everyone. I mean, there are poets that are very well known, like Ilya Kaminsky is very well known. And I think Ada Limon is very well known. And I broke my own rule with Ada, because I feel like Ada just writes these certain kinds of poems that resonate so much and positively with so many kind of readers. And I've just been putting a lot of, you know, really darker poems in there. And I wanted to include one of her poems, even though she was in it just last year. I broke my own rule because I've been trying really hard to put people who haven't been in there before or who haven't been in there for like 6 years or something like that. And so I would say everyone that I put in so far, except for maybe those two people, I think everyone else is really not known. I mean, even Itel Adnan is a visual artist, more so known as a visual artist, a painter, than maybe she's known as a writer, you know, and she published past tense with Nightboat Books, which is not a really well-known press amongst the general population. Obviously, I know Nightboat Books and a lot of writers do, but I don't think the average reader of the New York Times may. And so those are kinds of the things that I'm thinking about. And I always have a lot of difficulty naming names because I'm very equitable. You know, I feel like everyone has their own gifts, you know, and there are so many. I could like name any writer, any poet, I could name their gifts, you know. I feel like everyone has them. So I tend not to focus on like the kind of literary star culture that we have. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we have continued to prove to ourselves that that's the model that we really like as a culture. And I really tend to advocate for a more evenness, you know, like everyone has their own gifts, and what a gift to read poems by any practicing writer, really. And I really think there's so many great poets that I've picked, and people have picked in the past. I mean, I look at the list of people in the past, and I mean, I'm looking at it right now. It's like Rita Dove, Diane Seuss, Tracy K. Smith, Aria D. Matthews. This is just from last year. Roger Reeves. I love Roger Reeves' new book, but because he was in there just in August of last year, I was kind of disappointed to see that, because I would have loved to pick a Roger Reeves poem, but I said, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to look harder. I'm going to work harder. I'm going to find other people to put in there.
So. Oh, that's beautiful. That was such a wonderful answer. Thank you. Yeah. And also Ada Limon is one of my very favorite poets. I'm just, everything she writes, incredible.
Yeah, I think everyone likes her poems. You know, maybe not everyone loves every one of her poems, but everyone loves some of her poems. You know, like I think she's just, you know, she does what she does really well. There's no other way to say it.
So if you don't mind, I have two more questions that I typically ask everybody, and then I'll have you read a little bit. So this is a very general question, but what is an act of kindness that you've received that felt transformative in your life or had some big impact?
An act of kindness. Wow. To narrow it down to one act feels really hard. I feel like people deliver to me acts of kindness every single day. I'm trying to think in my writing life if there have been acts of kindness that have really helped me along the way. For me, I have to say, and I've talked about this in the past, I never really had like one person that really believed in my work and mentored me in my whole writing life. And I can't name one person, but I can name a lot of people who took like little interest in me, if that makes sense, who helped me along the way. But I, you know, I don't think anyone ever tagged me as being like a star or a great writer or anything like that. And I I don't have any feelings about that negatively or positively. It just is a fact. And so, you know, normally I would say, oh, this person really shaped my work. I can't really name a person who's shaped my work because I don't really think people took an interest in my work in a singular kind of way that I see sometimes happen with mentors and mentees. But people have definitely helped me along the way and have showed me all kinds of kind acts, you know, and I think a lot of editors. I was just thinking about this the other day too. It's like, there's so many editors who have just been such big cheerleaders of my work and of me as a result. And I've built up such strong affinity or relationships with these editors and these literary journals over the years that I have such an affection toward them. I mean, early on, it was Virginia Quarterly Review, also the New England Review. Agni, I feel very warm towards Agni. And also literary journals like Zizova and Oscar Villayon there, and, you know, Ted Genoese at VQR and C.D.L. Young at New England Review. Like, those were all really early supporters of my work. Kenyon Review, which is David Baker and David Lynn early on. You know, like, I feel like all of the editors do so much tireless work and support people by finding your work and then getting it out into the world. I think those are all acts of kindness because it's so much work that goes into it now that I know this because I do a lot of editorial work myself.
Right, of course. Yeah, and that sort of reminds me of, there was a line in Dear Memory when you were in Dear Daughters about that it took me a long time to find my people and that you did in the artistic community. And it was like refreshing to hear that too, because I think that a lot of us, like, it takes a while to find your people, you know, mm-hmm. where you're like, okay, right. This feels like a homecoming of sorts, right?
Definitely. Yeah. And I think something I've been thinking a lot about lately related to that is, like, you do have to be careful in the literary world too, because, you know, there are lots of good people, but because it's so scarcity model oriented that some of the really ugly aspects of human nature comes out in the literary world that may not come out in other parts of the world and other communities or workplaces that I've been in, because there's so much more to go around. You know, there's so much more money, resources, you name it. But in the literary world, I have found my people. I would say more of that is in the books and the writing versus the actual people. Like, I still have a lot of reservations about the literary community at large and also literary people specifically, because I have trust issues with them, because I feel like it is just, again, we are subjects of our capitalistic model, and it really does bring out the very worst in people that I have seen, the very, very worst in over my entire existence. Like, I think some of the worst actors in my life have been writers. And I find that to be discouraging. So yeah. I'm still a little bit reserved about it. But I would say when I have found my people, it really is. It's books, it's writing. You know, I think that's where I feel so connected when I'm reading something that was written 100 years ago that I'm like, yes, yeah. I completely respond to this. But maybe the people is not quite as strong.
Oh, yeah, it's sort of like, you know, meeting your, like, some celebrity that, you know, you're just like biggest fan of, and then they turn out to be a jerk, you know? Oh my
gosh, right. Or not as blank as you thought they were. You know, it's like, it's better to live in your imagination and to fill in those connections through imagination versus having these expectations of false clubbiness or false connection that you might have with other writers in your community. I just think that for me, keeping an arm's length from people in the literary community has actually been healthier for me in the long run.
Yeah. And that's, it's actually really good. It's good for personally for me to hear this. And I think it's because I'm just entering it, you know, and
sure.
I think it's so easy to get just so excited that that thing about trust, it's like, it really, I mean, I have been burned over and over again because of just trusting, you know, and for me, it wasn't just the literary community, it's just the artistic community, which has been such a gift in some way, in so many ways. And most of my best friends are artists, but also I've been deeply hurt by artists as well.
Yeah.
So, because we're artists.
Exactly. We're not, you know, maybe the kindest and most generous. Like, we are not always at our best.
That
can be really ugly and it manifests itself in really awful ways sometimes.
And we're complicated people.
We are. And so I've had a lot of observations about artists and writers, especially poets, over the years. And I've learned it's best for me just to, you know, it's always best for me to keep an arm's length distance, because it can be dangerous and for me, but other people may just jump fully.
It can be devastating.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Well, the last question before I have you read something is another kind of general question, but can you name a piece of art, you know, book, album, film, anything that's been important to you in your life?
Oh my gosh.
I know, that's kind of an annoying question.
So much. I'm sure everyone's responded exactly the same way. I would say, just because I just finished a book maybe earlier this year that was ekphrastic, that I would say visual art for me has always been very important in my life. But I haven't had as much time to kind of immerse myself in it, because I'm always doing 1,000 things. But because I was working on that book and poems, and I made it an effort, I think, to do a lot of research and reading about different artists and visual artists. And so that has been really important to me. So I would say a whole slew of artists during a certain time period were very important to me, and still are. And so I've always liked going to museums and galleries and just looking at stuff. And so I think that's just been a big part of my life. So I would say any kind of visual art, I'm always interested in, more so than music, even though I grew up playing a ton of instruments, you know, from the piano to percussion. Like, I was, you know, I had to play percussion because my sister was this amazing percussionist. And so I then also, you know, was forced to do the drum line and play marimba and, you know, do all these things that I wasn't really that interested in. And I played a lot of Chinese instruments too, like the moon guitar. And music was just not, it's something I was, you know, okay at, but it wasn't something that resonated with me. Whereas the drawing and the visual art was always something I was more interested in.
Awesome. Well, that really spills into your work. And I, you know, even the music though, because I think, and I wouldn't call myself a poet, so I can't say this for any certainty, but I would think that having that musical background maybe helps a little bit with the poetry.
Oh, it does.
Okay.
It does. So sometimes, and it's like I'll be talking with another poet about another poet or poetry, and then somebody might say, oh, that poet is just doesn't have any musical ear at all. And, and they'll, like, you hear people saying that a lot, or they'll say that poet has such a wonderful ear for music. And I do think that music and the ability to hear language and how it modulates and changes and collides with other language is very, very important to poetry.
That's why I think it's also important to read your work out loud, you know, when you're writing.
Yeah. And I think it's important to in prose as well. I mean, if I had a penny for every really dull piece of prose that I've read, and just like how flat this prose is, it's like, I can't even tolerate it. And sometimes I just stop reading altogether.
With you. Yeah. You can really feel that too.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. This has been such a wonderful conversation. And could we maybe end it by having you read something of your choice?
Sure. Well, do you want me to read anything in particular? I don't really care.
Not at all. That's the problem. Let's see. Well, do you feel like reading something maybe from your latest, The Trees Witness Everything?
Sure. I can read some stuff from there. I mean, I could just start doing, they're tiny poems, so I can read a few of them.
That'd be great.
So they're in syllabics, and they're in all these different various forms. There are two on each page. And as I mentioned earlier, they use W.S. Merwin's poems as titles. So I'll just start reading from the beginning. Far along in the story. Once I sat in rain, opened my mouth to the sky. I yearned to be changed, but each drop was a small knife. At first I fainted, but when I woke up, all the ticking had gone and all the centuries were one. my choices no longer hurt. Losing a language. We were born with a large door on our backs. When will we know if it opens? This one's called Little Soul. I rode on your back until your knees broke, and now 1 mile left, I must toss you. Turning. My mother is dead. The lemons still turn yellow. The trout still stare emptily. Desire is still free. We still love many people. Eat peaches as if kissing.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Victoria. This is such a heartwarming conversation. Really, it's wonderful.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This episode was audio produced by Katie McMurrin. The music is by Madison Ward.